This is an ABC podcast.
Betty Klimenko is a total petrol head. She's the only woman in Australia to have her own professional car racing team, Erebus Motorsports. It's a highly disciplined business, run like a military operation, with serious money being invested. And her team has known the sweet taste of victory at Bathurst. Betty lives in a champagne suburb, but she looks much more like a Bundy and Coke girl. She was adopted by her parents, John and Etta, at a time when they were living in a modest home in Sydney, but the family fortunes were about to climb dramatically. Her dad, John Saunders, and Frank Lowy were on the verge of opening their first Westfield shopping centre. Betty Klimenko was brought up as the heir apparent to the family business, but she walked away from it to marry the man of her dreams. Now, aside from running Erebus Motorsport, Betty also runs a charity for kids called Feel the Magic. Hello and welcome, Betty.
Hello.
Now, I'm guessing you've got a few cars in your garage. Have you got a muscle car in there somewhere?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
It's called the Beast, and it's a GT. Now you've got me. Holden GTS 507.
That's just numbers and letters
just
to me.
That's what I was.
Right. I heard the GT bit there.
Yeah,
right.
It is faster than my race car.
Is it?
It is much faster than my race car. I love it. I actually put my arms around it. I wash it, which is very, 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 very rare for me.
Well, you hold it, do you?
Like, yeah, I do.
Is it like your baby?
I do. Yeah, of course it is.
Right.
HSV, that was it. HSV,
right.
GTS 507.
And how do you put your arms? Do you sort of sprawl across the bonnet, or do you sort of, or around the column? How do you actually hold it?
I open the driver door and stand on the driver thing, and then just wrap my arms around the roof, and I give it a big kiss.
Do you get to take it anywhere where you can really let rip with it?
Legally, no. Unlegally, illegally, yes. No, it's really cool because you can go, if you go to Bathurst, there's a little program that comes up on your, where your sat nav is, and it's the Bathurst track, and you can actually time yourself going around Bathurst, except I just can't get the officials to move their barriers for me to do it.
Tell me the story that your parents gave you about how you were adopted by them way back in 1959.
Well, in 1959, it was a case of, quite a few children were up for adoption, and it wasn't waiting in line. You would wait. They would try and match a child to you, and they were looking for a child because they couldn't have children, and they were told that they had there was a child that would match the family, dark hair, you know, dark eyes. So they went to have a look at this child, and my father said, just wait a minute. So he walked up and down the aisles, and basically I was the last baby. And apparently I was giggling. He said, I want this child. She's got a sense of humour. And that's exactly how it was.
And you were adorable.
Of course, always adorable.
Do you have any memories of your mum and dad together?
Yeah, I do. I remember them. She used to make her own clothes. And I remember her after we just moved into our first house that my father had built after he started Westfield. And I remember her getting dressed for I think it was the opening of Burwood, and she looked like a movie star. And she had cancer, and there was a lot of pain, but she never let it show through. And I remember bits and pieces of her. I remember her talking to me. I remember that she got very, very sick, and I didn't understand what it was. So I would push her. And the worst memory I have is the fact that the day she died, I forgot to say goodbye to her in the car. And that haunts me forever.
I've seen a photo of them together, and your mum looks very glamorous. They were both Jewish people who fled to Australia from Hungary.
After the war, yeah.
In the Holocaust and all that. Did you know anything of that when you were growing up?
Yeah, I did. More in my older years when my father started the Sydney Jewish Museum, and my husband and I actually worked in there, physically worked, putting up walls, putting up things, and he made me go through every single photo so that I could see that whatever was being said, because words are cheap, but the photos and the film wasn't. And I would not wish those photos to be seen by hardly anyone, but I sat there and looked through them and understood why he did what he did, why he does what he did, you know what I mean.
How did he start out in business once he came to Australia? What were his first businesses?
He worked for Anthony Hordens as a packer storeman. which is really spooky because my second husband, Daniel's relative, actually married into the Horden family. Mm. He tried to grow mushrooms underneath where he was living. He tried to learn a whole lot of things, and he ended up having a delicatessen, and that's where he met Frank, and as they say, the rest is history.
Yeah, why do you think those two hit it off?
I know why they hit it off, because Frank was the only delivery boy that actually was on time.
Right, so they were clearly ambitious then.
Oh, yeah. It was, I remember him telling me that he said to Frank, do you want to come into business with me? And Frank goes, but I have no money. And he says, nor do I. I'm trying to buy the air above the railway station. And the council thought he was absolutely mad, because why do you want to buy air? What are you going to do with air? Because in those days there were no shops above train stations and anything else. And they tried to find money, and they finally found a bank that would lend them the money. And that's where it all started.
Was this based on observation on how shopping was going in America, the trend of the future with shopping?
Exactly. You know, he saved up. He did one trip to America and he came back with all these ideas. I mean, even strip malls really didn't exist back then. It was the corner shops and that was it. And he had this idea that it could be done in Australia.
And he did it.
Yeah, he did it.
And he did it. Where was the first Westfield that he opened up? Was that in the western suburbs of Sydney?
I'm not sure, but I think it could have been Hornsby. I don't want to be pinpointed on this because everyone will tell me I'm wrong. I'm always wrong.
And why Westfield? Where did they get that name from?
Because when the bank manager came to look at the plot of land, they were standing in a field in the western suburbs, and that's exactly what my
that's
father
it,
said.
Wasn't right.
He goes, we're in a field, we're in the western suburbs, let's call it Westfield. And that was it.
Your dad's name was Jano Schwartz. That's right.
Yancy Schwartz.
Yancy Schwartz.
And he was, everyone told me he had to anglicise his name. So he was in the city walking in the Strand Arcade. There was a jeweller called John Saunders Jewellery. And he said, that sounds good, like a good name. That's the name I'm going
to
have.
Do you think it bothered him having to change his name?
No, I don't think so. You know, nothing much bothered my father. I think he just understood that this is what will be.
You mentioned your mum died when you were quite young from cancer. Who did she leave behind? Did you have siblings at that stage?
I had a brother who's 5 years younger than me, but he's intellectually handicapped, paranoid, schizophrenic and autistic. And I asked my father many, many years later, you know, if you knew there was something wrong with my brother, why did you adopt him? He said, because if I didn't, he would end up on the streets. And I loved it. I loved the fact that, you know, he understood that there needed to be a place for everybody, and if you can, you should.
How did you discover that you were adopted?
We were at the Lowy's house. We used to go there just like anyone else would go to an auntie or an uncle, and I was having a fight with their middle boy, Peter, and it just, I don't know how it just turned around and he just yelled at me and said, you're adopted. So you got to remember, I was, you know, blonde-haired, blue-eyed, chubby little thing that kind of understood that there was something not right about being a blonde-haired, blue-eyed little kid in a family of all dark-haired people. So marched myself upstairs and just walked up to my father, stood in front of him, said, am I adopted? And he goes, yes. And I just went, thought so, and walked away. It was no big thing. It wasn't... Never shattered my world, just put a few, you know, ticked a few boxes and said, yep. And at that age, and when you're only little, if you can compartmentise that, you're fine.
Did he put you to work when you were little in shopping centres?
He used to drag me every Saturday. We would drive from centre to centre. And if the toilet wasn't clean, he wouldn't ask for a cleaner. He'd do it himself. And we had the Shore Inn at our Tarman. And one day we went there and the dishwasher, as in the human dishwasher, had walked out because the chef had yelled at them. And everyone was running around because the dishes were dirty and, you know, there were no more clean dishes. So my father rolled his sleeves and my sleeves up and would not let anyone back in the kitchen until every single pot and pan was clean.
That's extraordinary.
And he made me work there for 5 years.
Was that a good idea to do? What do you think of the virtues of doing that? Like stepping in and doing the washing up like that?
He always said, you can't ask someone to do something that you won't do yourself. And it has worked brilliantly for me because if you've done it, you've done it and you know exactly what it involves.
You're not frightened of that kind of work either.
Oh, God, no.
No. So without your mum there, did you have a nanny to come in and help bring you up as you were?
Yeah, we did. A beautiful woman called Nessie Collins. She wasn't there for long, but I remember because she was there before my mother died and during the time that she died and then afterwards for maybe 4 years or 3 years, and she lost her own son during that time. But she had a lot to do with the way I am, and she was a big woman. Tall, you know, she's tall and big in size. And I always say, when I die, I want to die like she did. Sail of the Century just started. And it was, she'd made her husband dinner and there was a cake and she sat down to watch her favourite show with a piece of cake and a cup of tea, which she finished. The show ended. The guy that she wanted, he won the grand prize, the first one ever won. She sat back in the chair and died. And to me, that's just like, yes, that is so the way I'm going.
It might have to be Family Feud or something like that.
Oh,
I don't know.
I'm not into Family Feud. Probably some sci-fi movie or the end of the actual real end of Supernatural.
Right. And then that's it, in your Jason recliner.
That's exactly what she did. I thought, how well planned was that?
Your dad remarried when you were 15 years old. 15 years old is a tender age for daughters. How did you?
I wouldn't say I was okay with it, but you got to understand, she was only 10 years older than me, so we were, wouldn't say close in age, but it was. I've been brought up by going to a Church of England school with a Church of England nanny in that atmosphere, and then all of a sudden comes this woman who has this deep Jewish tradition and deep Jewish everything, and two worlds just clashed. I mean, I loved her. She was weird and wacky and sometimes totally off a tree, but she taught me a lot as well. She taught me how to cook for 30 people. She taught me how to believe in myself even while we weren't talking. Like, everyone thought we were fighting, she'd ring me up and say, let's go for coffee. And we'd go for coffee as if nothing happened. And then in front of everyone else, we're still fighting. So we had our ups and downs, but she was emotionally scarred woman, but she tried her hardest to overcome it all.
And you could see that she was trying for you?
It wasn't for me. She wasn't trying for me or my brother. It was for my dad and her daughter, my father's third child, which is my sister. And there's 19 years between me and my sister. So I was old enough to be her mother. But now we love each other dearly and we agree on everything.
Still, did your dad still hold a place in his heart for your mother?
Oh, yes. And when he got married for the second time, he told his new wife that when he dies, he'll be buried next to my mother. He had already bought the plot. And that was just a given. He loved her so much. And it was sad to see such a great love being shattered. But life goes on.
So did you have this sense of, I don't know, going from house to house or going from posh place, like the sense of ramping up the quality of one's, you know, the family home as you were growing up? Because Westfield did pretty well, I think it's fair to say, Betty, didn't it? And so
yeah, but when you're a child, you don't think about that.
You don't?
All right. I remember asking my father once, do we have $1 million? And he just looked at me and he said, we have enough. Right. There was no other answer to that. Because kids cannot, in their mind, put $1 million together. So there was no reason to say yes or no. But he didn't let us live like that. He had a place in New Zealand and we'd go there for our holidays and he would put on sandals and socks and chop wood very unsuccessfully. You know, 9 out of 10 times having an accident, bashing his head somewhere, doing something. But for him, that was where he got away and could just be himself.
How did he teach you the business?
Probably it would be child cruelty to her today. He put a chair at the end of his desk. He called me. It was my first day of work. I came in a suit expecting to be, you know, vice president or director or something else.
And how old were you when this happened?
Oh, it was just...
You in teens still?
No. I was older than that. I was in the 80s, early 80s. And he put a chair at the end of his desk and said, sit. So I sat. And that's where I sat for a good few years. I didn't say anything. I just sat and listened. And he said, you won't learn anything from books. You'll only learn by being part of. And I watched him. It was hard. It was very hard not to say something and to know that your job consisted of going to work and sitting down in a chair all day. But it was some of the best things I ever learned was by learning to be quiet.
Learning to be quiet.
Yeah.
And just listening and observing.
Yeah, it was hard for me because I'm a chatterbox. I love to have a chat, but I learned to bite my tongue and just sit there and watch. And, you know, one room, there's just so much you can look at, and then you stop looking at stuff and you start listening properly.
You become a student of people then? Knowing what, look what
so.
They say
yeah,
and hearing.
I think so. And the way people look at you, the way people either open up to you or they don't open up to you. And I'm very funny. If I don't like someone within the first 2 minutes, I'll just walk away from them. I'll just say, thank you, bye.
Do you get a sense of, observing people, what they might be saying something, but you can sort of get a better idea of what they really want by observing their body language, their facial expression?
Oh, all the time. It's and my husband's very good at that as well. I think that's why we get on so well, because he has insights that I wouldn't even think of. And we have babble time where we can talk about anything and not be criticised for it. And I love that. I love the fact that my nonsense sounds not like nonsense to him. I like to talk about zombies and, you know, I've got a thing about zombie apocalypse, you know. And he'll sit and listen to my idiot, you know, stupid talk. Or we go to weddings and he'll come up to me and he goes, puts his arm gently around me, says, not everyone wants to talk about motorsport, Betty. So I haven't really not much to say to women. I've actually been put in a position where I was at a table with all these women and I went, in my head I'm going, think of a topic. And I couldn't. And I was going, they don't want to talk about cars, they don't want to talk tyres, they don't want to talk pressures or gauges or roll bars. And I'm going, oh, think pink. So I had a T-shirt made up, think pink.
When did you graduate from the end of your father's desk?
Oh, well, look, it was only a couple of years and then he walked me up to an office and he opened the door and he said, this is yours. And I was so excited. It was like I was let out of, you know, the giant void. And I took in flowers and plants and I put in photos, but I so loved it.
Tell me about the first time you went with your dad to McDonald's,
Well, unfortunately, my father didn't have any street skills. So we walked into McDonald's. We're on the way up to the Central Coast and we stopped at McDonald's and I said, well, what do you want? He says, he just looked at the menu and he goes, I have one of everything. And I said, what? He says, you can't have one of everything. He said, well, how do I know what I like if I don't have one of everything? And then he just went, okay, fine. I ordered one of everything. The woman looked at me. I said, nope, he wants one of everything and a knife. And we cut it all up. Of course, we didn't order anything extra. We cut them all up and he took a little quarter of every burger. And
did he find something he liked?
Yeah, he did. He liked the Big Mac. He was very funny about it. You know, he said, why are people looking at me? I said, Daddy, you've got one of everything in front of you. He says, so? He could not get over the fact that that ordering one of everything wasn't a normal thing to do.
Did anyone grab the food afterwards? Because he clearly couldn't have eaten all of that.
Oh, there were five of us, so we kind of didn't order, but we kind of got through it.
Anyway. He was a Holocaust survivor. So
yes.
Was he big on survival tips for you?
Yes, he was. And I still carry them out to today.
And what are they?
Never stay above the seventh floor in a hotel and always face the street because fire engines' ladders only go up to the 7th/10th floor. And after that, you're on your own. So he kept telling us, when you go to a restaurant, always make sure you're facing the door so you can see if the bad man's coming. If you go to an airport, make sure you're sitting next to an exit in case something happens. You can run out the exit door. And just all these little things, I still do them. I still don't stay, if I can help it, stay above the seventh floor. We were in Malaysia, in Kuala Lumpur, and the lady took us to our room and it was on the 30th floor or something. And I started to sweat. I said, do you have something lower? And she goes, no, the rest is all like offices or reception rooms or something. And I sweated the whole time I was there. I just couldn't handle it. I was just like, you know, do you have a bat pole or something? You know, that would make it easier if there's a fire. But he really pushed it.
He would have known. I'm just trying to sort of get the trajectory of your father's life in my head, having seen how things can go so very badly wrong before he gets to Australia. And then he's a gigantic shopping centre bazillionaire after that. To go from one to the other, I suppose he would have gone through life knowing that all of this can go in a minute, all of this could disappear, and terrible, terrible, terrible things can happen. You think that haunted him?
It did. We had a farm, and I have a farm now. And he loved going to the farm. He felt safe there, and I feel safe in my – ours is in Robertson in the Southern Highlands. And he always made me feel safe, and that was a big thing after he died, that I didn't feel safe. I didn't feel that he was – I didn't feel that there was someone there. Even though you can be married, you still – a parent is someone that you can – it's a different type of hug, a different type of safety. Now it doesn't bother me so much, but I have a pretend phone at home, one of the old dial ones, and I pick it up and ring him. I know it sounds really loony, but I remember his number and I just ring his number. And I just think about him, you know, just that act of dialing the numbers just brings me a little bit of, a bit OCD.
No, that sounds really lovely. Do you talk, though?
Yeah, sometimes. Like at Bathurst, I spoke to him after we won Bathurst. And I just went, you're either really, really proud or really, really angry at me now. But, you know, either way, look what I've done. I've made my own footprint.
He wouldn't be angry with you. Why would he be angry with you for winning Bathurst?
He was also very traditionalist. Yeah, he's a traditionalist. And he believed that after I divorced my first husband, that my second husband should have been a lawyer or a doctor. And it wasn't. It was a boy that worked for the Australian Defence Force. So I never really stuck to the plan. But I think after the end of everything, he understood my plan was okay.
So like I said, you got married for the first time, didn't work out, had two kids, and then you met Daniel. How did you meet Daniel?
In a pub at the Rocks, the Observer Hotel.
That just tripped right off your tongue there.
Oh, yeah. It was interesting. He was 19 and I'd just turned 30. No, I was 29, nearly 30.
10-year difference.
Right? 10-year difference. And back then in the 80s, that was a huge difference for a woman. And I just looked at him and I knew, my life flashed before my eyes right up to the day I die, and I just saw us being two old people in rocking chairs, you know, in the middle of nowhere, just laughing.
Or just what, in a moment?
You got in a moment. I just knew we were married. And that we're going to have this life together that's just going to be incredible. And it has been.
And did Daniel know that too in that moment?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. We treated each other like we're an unmarried couple from the day we met.
And what did your dad think of him?
He didn't think of him. He thought about him as in wrong side of the tracks, wrong religion, wrong this, wrong that. And so he disowned me.
He disowned you just like that?
Yeah.
What do you mean, like you are no longer to inherit the family business?
Everything gone.
Didn't want to talk to you either?
No, didn't want to talk to me. But he did. I rang him every day for the 3 years that I didn't talk to him, and his secretary would put me through and he wouldn't say a word. He'd just listen and I'd tell him everything that was happened in the day, and then when he'd heard enough, he'd put the phone down.
So that's why you call him now?
Yeah, probably.
Actually, it's the same phone call, isn't it?
I actually didn't think of it. It's the same phone call. I don't expect an answer. I just I told him about, and if I didn't ring, the secretary would ring me and say, do you want to talk to him today?
Wait, you're not talking.
Yeah, maybe well, he I wasn't was busy. Talking. Yeah, maybe, yeah, but he wasn't talking, but I did the talking. And then when my third son was born, he walked into the hospital, looked at me and said, beautiful boy, and walked out. And that's when it all went back together.
So when you were separated, though, you went to live with Daniel where? Where did you go?
We lived in Matraville in his grandparents' old house.
Right, that would have been when it was a rough as guts old suburb back in those days.
Yeah, and here is a girl from Bellevue Hill that has all this furniture that does not fit into the house.
How much of a culture shock was that for you?
I thought, you know, I thought there were little fairies that pick up your clothes and just put them back in your cupboards.
So there you are having to wash clothes, pick them up.
4 o'clock in the morning line. Getting up to make him ham sandwiches.
Right, for your kids and all that. Did you resent it?
Not resent it. I just wanted my fairies back. But I got to love it. And I think that every princess should do that.
Broadcast, podcast, and online. You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feiler on ABC Radio. Subscribe to our free podcast service. Details on our website, abc.net.au/conversations.
You said that for a while you were disowned by your dad, and then you had a child, another child. And tell me about that moment, though, when he finally came into the room and used that as the kind of point of reconciliation with you.
I found it to be very strange, actually, the fact that he walked in. And, I mean, my son was 12 pounds when he was born and he was 25 inches. He's now 6'5", 6'6". And my husband and I are not that tall, so it was a bit of a surprise. But
well, if you keep feeding him, they'll do that, you know, eventually, won't they? I mean, yes, that's the thing. So he got a great big tall grandson. Did that please
exactly.
him, did it?
Loved it. You know, for him, you know, he wasn't that – well, he was tall, but he wasn't that tall. And I think he loved the fact that he had three grandsons and they were big and strong and they could defend the family. And it was important for him.
Come the zombie Holocaust.
Yes.
The one that you've been waiting for.
Yeah, I am. I'm waiting. I honestly think that some idiot out there is going to invent a virus and then we're all just going to – it's just going to be
– and your son will be
zombies.
The dude on the motorbike with the crossbow or something like that. And
be
able to look after the whole family.
Yeah, look, I tried to talk my husband into having a pop-up wall at the farm and he just wouldn't be in it.
What kind of a granddad was John?
He's about the same granddad as I'm the grandmother. I have four grandchildren. We're there in spirit. We don't do babysitting very well. After 10 minutes, it's like, where's the mother? I want to give it back. But we love them dearly. And just we're not the babysitting type people. We need to be out there doing something.
So did he ask you to come back to work after that?
Yeah, he did. He did. But my father was very, very – business was his life. I mean, I missed my son's first birthday because I was with my father in Los Angeles working. And I said, but it's my son's first birthday. He said, do you think he's going to remember? It's not like it's his 10th. And I was like, okay.
What did you find when you went back to the office?
That my ivy had grown all over the office and it was still exactly how I left it. Just a little dusty but still clean and
so
it
when
just
he,
happened.
When he, so when he disowned you, he just closed the door on it, did he?
And left it alone. And my house. And I had to leave my house. I had to leave everything and take my furniture and go.
So it was like the bedroom of a child who's died or something.
Yeah, exactly. And then I just came back and it was just started like nothing had happened.
In 1997, he had a heart attack. And where were you when you got the news?
I was in Sydney. My father was in the Gold Coast. And my sister and I quickly got on the plane and went up to the Gold Coast. And he had a sense of humour even when he was dying because, well, not a sense of humour so much, but I walked in. I was in my tracksuit because I ran straight from home to the airport. And I walked into the hospital and he says, in my drawer is my wallet. Take it and get some better clothes. And I looked at him and just went, what? He said, I don't want to see you in a tracksuit while I'm dying. And I was like, you're not dying. If you can think like that, you're not dying. So I had to go to Pacific Fair or whatever it was and buy myself some decent clothing.
Oh, dear. Really? Mm-hmm. And he's going to bang on about that while he's...
Yes. So I knew that he wasn't going to die that moment.
Right. Is he at that point had become estranged also from Frank Lowy?
I wouldn't call it estranged. It was more they went their different ways. Frank had three sons. The business ended up being with those three sons. And my father retired from Westfield. And if it wasn't estranged because he built literally next door so they could still have lunch together. They just went their different ways for a while. But towards the end, Frank and him saw each other nearly every day. And, you know, I'd walk into the hospital, they'd be laughing and talking about something that happened in the old days. And they loved each other, just sometimes they found it hard to show it to each other.
When he died, did that come as a shock then, given that you thought he was
it didn't come as a shock, but it came as this is the end. This is the end of this part of my life. And I just found it hard to think that I just couldn't talk to him anymore, that I couldn't feel him under my hand or, you know, I remember the night before he died, I kissed him on the forehead 8 times and I don't know why I kissed him 8 times on the forehead, but it changed my life. And some people, you're either honest with yourself or you're not. And with me, I was very honest because he'd been sick for a very long time. And it was like something was lifted off my shoulders. I would have rather had it on my shoulders for the next 50 years if I could have had him alive. But that was the way it was. And I accepted the fact that he was gone.
So there was a kind of freedom in it.
Yeah, there is. There's
a cold
always,
freedom, perhaps.
It doesn't matter what anyone says, there is always a freedom if someone's been in pain and someone's been suffering, and when they do pass away, there is like a sigh of relief, as in this is over for everyone. For them, the pain's over. For us, the question when, why, what, it's over. It's, you know, it's time to get on with life because it's the only way is to go forward.
Do you still hear his voice?
All the time. I've done the things that are so stupid and I've heard him say in my ear, "What are you doing, you stupid girl?" That's it. And I just go, yeah, yeah, yeah. Just it's like this little conscience devil on my shoulder.
I just wonder what that'd be like to go through life with a kind of Hungarian voice going, "What are you doing?"
Oh, it's interesting. It's interesting.
Once he died, what did you do with all those suits he insisted you wear?
I burnt them.
You burnt them?
I had a bonfire and I burnt them all, except for one. And that was the first suit he ever bought me. And it was a very expensive suit. And I didn't really want it, but he bought it for me anyway. In France, he bought me a Ferragamo suit and it was like, okay, that stays. That's the one thing. So I've still got that wrapped up in paper somewhere.
I've seen photos of you from that time when you were kind of wearing plausible suits and you look like a kind of, I don't know, a quote-unquote respectable businesswoman. You look like you're a lot happier and more comfortable in your skin these days.
Oh, so much so. I mean, there's a lot to be said for between nurture and nature. I was a very nurture child, but there were things in my nature that came through and I was very artistic. I loved to draw, I loved to paint, I loved to write, and that came through. I really always wanted a tattoo. So I waited till I was 47, which was 10 years after my dad had passed away, before I got my first tattoo. So I waited till my kids went through school and everything else before I got my tattoos.
I just got this image of you sort of walking into a tattoo parlor in the Cross or something like that and hearing, "What are you doing?" Yeah. Did you have a bit of that? I mean,
well, we were in Vegas.
Right.
And Daniel my husband was anti-tattoos. And I kept pushing him, "Let's go to Hart and Huntington, Hart and Huntington." So that was like the place to go. So we went there and you had to actually come and wait in the line, and there were you can't make an appointment. So the line was like forever long. So I said, we'll think about it. And next door was a Mexican restaurant. We went in there and got plastered on margaritas, and I drew a design for my first tattoo. Went back and I thought, oh, he's not going to, you know, we're not going to go. Anyway, he woke me up early and said, "Come on." I said, "What?" He said, "Don't you want that tattoo or not?" So we end up making really good friends with our tattoo artist, and he's the only one bar one tattoo. He did all the rest. The one tattoo he didn't do is the one I got in New Zealand to honour my father because he loved the country. So I've got a tattoo that means one side means the South Island and the other side means family.
Where have you got tattoos? Arms, shoulders?
Yeah, that's the New Zealand one.
Right, that's it's kind of Maori
mainly
design.
My arms yeah. and across my back, and I've got one on my leg, which no one will ever see.
Have you finished with tats now?
Probably not. It's addictive, but I forget I've got them, and I'll go to a function, I'll take my jacket off, and I think, why is everyone staring at me? And then I go, oh, yeah, that's right.
Well, there's your conversation icebreaker when you're meeting with women who don't want to talk about motorsport. You can talk
I've
about
been
your
in
tats.
A lift with a woman, an elderly woman, in Double Bay, and she took a step backwards. And I thought, what is she doing? She's moving backwards in a lift. And then it dawned on me. I was wearing a T-shirt. The tattoos were out. I had really ultra-short hair, bleach blonde, and I was wearing bikey boots. And I went, don't worry, I'm not going to hurt you. And she just kept on walking. And I said to her, do you realise we're in a lift? You can't, there's nowhere to go. And, of course, when I say there's nowhere to go, she automatically thinks I'm going to rob her. So I put my hand up. I said, I've got a 7-carat diamond ring on my finger. I don't need yours. I mean, the things that come out of my mouth sometimes are just ridiculous. Anyway, we got the door open, and I've never seen an old woman run so fast. So, you know, I thought, oh, well. She can think what she wants.
Like I say, a real icebreaker. They're the old tats there for a conversation in a lift with a nice old lady, isn't it?
Oh, I've had everyone comment on them saying either whether they're good or bad.
All right. Really? So people feel they can just do that? They can walk up and offer comments?
Some people think that they know me. Like when I on the street and someone says, hi, Betty, and I have to actually look at Daniel and go, do I know them? Because sometimes they're just fans and they'll just say, they know me, but I don't know them. And then I have to old-timer it and go, well, maybe I do know them, but I've just forgotten them or something else. But it just turns out I love it when people say hello to me. I really do.
This fame has come from your adventures in motor racing. Why did you want to get into motor racing anyway? How long had you been in love with motor racing?
Oh, I've been in love with motor racing my whole life, but it took my husband not getting his car on time and us going to Mount Cotton getting a defensive driving course, which ended up we sponsored a driver and then we sponsored a car. We worked our way all the way from F3s all the way up the series and then ended up in V8 supercars.
So this isn't something that you had as a little
No,
as
no,
a
20,
kid.
The last 20 years since my father died, I've been involved in motorsport.
So how do you then sort of decide you want to actually run a motorsport team? How do you get started in that kind of a game?
It just happened. We sponsored a driver and then we sponsored the car and then we bought a car, an F3, and then it graduated from F3s all the way up to GTs and we won the Bathurst 12-hour, we won a championship and there's only 6 rounds a year for GTs and I just went, I want to do more. And got the look with the eyes rolling back from my husband when I said, why don't we go into V8 supercars? Or at that time, V8s. And I knew the look. It was, here it comes. Because you're talking 16 rounds a year, millions and millions of dollars that you have to get from sponsors. It's a lot of work. You arrive in the dark, you leave in the dark. I mean, I don't know what Perth looks like, but I've been there 5 times. I just love it. It gets in your blood. It's the people, the officials, the fans.
What about the racing itself, though? I mean,
the racing.
Yeah.
This is the one sport that I call, you know, nose to tail. It's a very close sport, and it's not like F1s where everything is separated and there's cars going round and round a track. It's like a lot like NASCAR where there is action between overtaking and drivers and little nudges here and there and, yeah, you nudge me last corner, I'll nudge you this corner. I love the way that you have to strategize and that strategy and everything has to be done in a nanosecond because it's not like a football team where you can go time out. There is – you can't just stop the cars and go, hey, wait a minute. You know, it has to be done within less than a second.
My dad was crazy about motor racing. He took me to Bathurst when it was known as the Hardy Ferodo 1000 back in 1977. I saw Alan Moffat and Colin Bond get number 1 and 2 in a couple of blue and white Cobras there. Were you there that day as well?
Sort of.
Yeah. So what do you mean by sort of?
I was out on the night before on a Saturday night in Double Bay and I think I might have drunk a little bit too much and I ended up crawling into the back of someone's ute. And when I woke up, I went under the tarp, and when I woke up, I was at the top of the mountain at Bathurst. So it was an unusual start to my Bathurst history.
That's a four-hour drive, Betty.
Yeah, I know. I was very tired.
Very tired.
Very tired.
Tired, right.
I woke up and I had to walk down and find a phone, ring my father, reverse. You could do reverse calling back then. And he just yelled at me, "Where are you? We thought you were killed." I said, "I'm not killed. I'm at Bathurst." And he goes, "Why are you at Bathurst?" I said, "I don't know. That's where the man drove me." And then I had to explain that I didn't mean just any man drove me. And so he had to send someone up to pick me up.
From Bathurst.
I'd rather not think about the rest of that weekend.
Yeah, I remember. Mount Panorama can be like some sort of tour of Vikings has gone through the place at the end of a race day.
I love the top of the mountain. I go there every year, put on a tutu. It's a thing now. I wear a tutu made of one of the sponsors. Last year it was Kitten Car Care. Year before it was made out of Hungry Jack's wrappers. I don't know what I'm doing this year yet, but I go up there and the fans up there are amazing. They even make sure that I know that the bottle of water they're handing me is sealed, because we don't drink alcohol on the weekends. Like, we're working. And my most wonderful memories were this poor little boy. He must have been 19. He was drunk as a skunk. And he ended up, I was standing at the top of a hill and he was on his knees crawling up the hill going, "I love you, Betty. I want to marry you, Betty." Yeah, dude, I'm 50-odd years old. Anyway, the police saw him because he got a run-up, and the police saw him and his friends saw him. So you had the police coming in from the right, friends coming in from the left. He's started running like the zombie up the mountain screaming, "I love you, Betty." His friends got to him before the police got to him, which I was really sad. I wanted him to propose because he kept on saying, I'm going to propose.
I'll propose.
So I have had a few proposals. But you know what? These guys up there, they are so harmless. I've got this one group that play Black Betty every time I walk past them. So,
bam,
you know,
bam.
Yeah, look, they're harmless and I love them.
So it's part of the joy that it's really your success in this game has really got nothing to do with, not that much to do with the wealth you've inherited. I mean, you have millions, I suppose, to invest to begin with, but it's something you've built on your own, this thing, isn't it?
Yes. My father's shoes were very, very, very large, and there was no way that I was ever going to fill them with something that I wasn't overly passionate about. I'm passionate about motorsport. I'm making my own shoes. I've gone from a size 4 to about a size 8 at the moment. And we're doing extremely well this year. So, you know, Dave Reynolds is an amazing – happy birthday, by the way, Dave, off tomorrow, I think, yeah.
Right. He's your driver, yeah, that's right.
So he's the 3rd of July, I'm the 13th of July. So, you know, it's not very hard to remember his birthday.
I've been talking about the charity you support called Feel the Magic. Tell me a bit about that, please.
Well, my sister started first and I really didn't pay any attention. And then she said, "Look, there's a camp on. Will you come and do the camp?" I said, "Yeah, I'll come and do the camp." Just to get her off my back, I thought, I'll do it. And it was the weekend after the Newcastle round, which was the last round, and I was exhausted. So I arrived there and I was blown away. This is a section of the community that people just don't think about. It's children who are mourning the death of a sibling or a parent or a grandparent or a carer. And then I thought about myself and I thought, well, I grew up without ever having someone tell me that it was okay, that it's not my fault, that I don't have to carry the guilt. And a lot of kids you see that go through the judicial system, they come through and they use it as an excuse. My mother or father died when I was 10 years old, thus I became a drug addict, that's why I'm standing here. There's no reason for that. This charity was started by two wonderful people and they knew that you can change a child's life by getting them to understand what mourning is about, by allowing the grief to come out and allowing it's hard to explain, but they allow the child to become a child again and not have to carry the guilt.
Yes. Are you saying that, and I'm sure this is true, sadly, that when a child loses like a mother or father or a sibling or something, very often, instead of grief entering their heart so much, there's guilt.
A lot of guilt.
There's some guilt there. What do you think that's often guilt about?
Well, I had one child that was talking to me and they said, they had a younger brother who had got leukemia. So for 4 years, everything was about that brother. And the longer it went, the more rejected he felt. So he was feeling very – he was the healthy one, and he had to go to all the hospital, chemo. He had to go, and his brother – it was always about his brother. But when his brother died, he said, I felt so guilty because I was glad that he died, because now life could go back to normal. And this was about empowering that child himself to be able to say, hang on, it's not that you were happy. It was the fact that now in your child, the way your mind works, that you can go forward with your life and remember your brother as someone who was beautiful and special, not someone that took everything away from you. And children need this as much as adults do. And this charity puts one child to one adult, and they do, they hopefully will be doing 50 camps a year. But there are kids that have lost families or parents in such tragic circumstances that there has to be things running through their heads that we just don't know about.
Well, you were young when your mum died. Did you in some way feel responsible for that?
I held on to the guilt that I never said goodbye. It was the one time I didn't say goodbye to her in the car. Like, I just jumped out to be with my friends.
Oh.
And then no one picked me up in the afternoon, and I sat outside the school till 6 o'clock at night. And then I went into a shop and I said, look, can I use your phone? And I couldn't remember a phone number. And I just couldn't remember anything. In the end, I remembered one phone number, and then they sent someone to pick me up. And I stayed at the Lowy's place that night. And the next day, my father told me that my mother had died. But I carried the guilt of not saying goodbye. It can be a guilt of anything. It's not the guilt that she died. It was the guilt that I hadn't said goodbye.
You're talking about this now. Could you do that at the time? Did you say to your dad, I feel terrible, I was never able to say goodbye to her?
No, because he was dealing with it in his own way. She committed suicide, but he told me that she died in hospital. And it was only years later that I found out. He said, does it matter? I said, well, it does matter to me, because I know the amount of pain she was in. Because cancer back then, there wasn't what the treatments we have now. But I understand what happened now. And that's all I needed, was to understand.
Did your dad have any survivor's guilt, having survived the Holocaust, when I'm guessing members of his family did not?
I wouldn't call it survivor's guilt. He used whatever it was to push him forward and to bring out the best and do his best. And that's why he built the Sydney Jewish Museum. And, you know, I was very proud. I was always been very proud of my father. Might not liked him every day, but I still loved him every moment.
For a nice Jewish girl, you're pretty mad about Christmas.
I'm a Chrisaholic.
Chrisaholic?
I'm a Chrisaholic.
How does that show itself?
It lights on every part of my house. I'm practically the only house in the street that does it. Santas, and I have a few nights before Christmas, I have all my grandchildren over. It's only because I'm lazy. I give them all their presents so I don't have to drag them with me. But we do the whole – I put the air conditioning on as cold as it will go, then I put the fire on so that it feels more Christmassy. And, you know, I walk around singing Christmas carols all the time. And
why? Why do you like Christmas so much?
I just think it's a time when everyone forgets they hate each other.
Bringing everyone together, forget we hate each other. That's great. When do you start your countdown for Christmas anyway? When is this? You've got 12 days, or is it
I would love to have a much longer time countdown to Christmas. I have one in my head and I have everything ready to go, but my husband's birthday is on the 22nd of December and he doesn't like Christmas at all.
He doesn't like Christmas at all?
No, no. So he's the 22nd of December, my son's the 18th of December. So I have to wait with bated breath till mid-December until I kind of can get away with it, and then it just all goes up in about an hour, and then on Boxing Day it all comes down.
Tell me how you managed to celebrate an extra Christmas day into each year, how you managed to actually get
if you go to Hawaii and you leave on the afternoon of Christmas, you arrive there on Christmas Eve. So you can actually end up having two Christmases.
That's brilliant. What a pleasure it is to speak with you, Betty. It's been so enjoyable. What an amazing story. You've got to write this down somewhere. I know.
I've got so many stories it would probably raise the hair on the back of your neck.
You've done that a few times already today. It's been such a pleasure, Betty. Thank you so much.
Absolute pleasure.
Betty Klemenko is the owner of the Erebus Motorsport Team, and she's an ambassador for the children's charity Feel the Magic. And we'll put a link up for the charity on our website, abc.net.au/conversations. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.